Hour with Mark Morano on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the Mark Morano Show here on TNT Radio. We have an exciting program for you today. We are going to be talking about COVID, public health, the administrative state, the World Economic Forum, the United Nations, our crazy world of what's happened and what's accelerated since March of 2020, or actually a little before that. We're going to be joined, and joining me here momentarily is Jeffrey Tucker, the founder and president of the Brownstone Institute. And his most recent book is Liberty or Lockdown, available wherever fine books are sold. It's available on Amazon. And he's also, I believe, working on a new book, which will be out later, either later this year or next year. But we are happy to welcome to the program Jeffrey Tucker, a man who I quote in my book coming out, The Great Reset. This man has been a national treasure in terms of analysis when it comes to what's happened to our dystopian world since March of 2020. So welcome to the program, Mr. Tucker.
That's good to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, now you run the Brownstone Institute, and you're very active on Twitter. And I've been following you very closely since the COVID happened. Just as an overview, public health had never really supported lockdowns, never supported mandatory mask mandates, never supported ginning up public fare during any kind of public health crisis. What happened in 2020 that essentially changed and turned the world of public health on its head? How do you analyze how the world essentially went crazy over COVID-19.
If I had an easy answer to that, I wouldn't need the Brownstone Institute, honestly. I mean, that's what we're doing every day, and I'm asking these questions constantly. You know, it's just, look. And every day we're getting new answers. I will tell you, I just finished reading a paper. It's just published on ResearchGate that chronicles all-cause mortality having gone through the roof, you know, in 2021 and this year, and not related to COVID. It's everything else. So the lockdowns and harms are extreme and devastating. And it's not just about all-cause mortality, which has been catastrophic, but it's about the demoralization of the population, the economic crisis that we're dealing with right now, the cultural crisis, the rise of nihilism, a kind of a brutalism in politics. It was all unleashed, I would say, starting March, you know, 12th-ish, when the curtain began to fall on the lights of civilization. And how and why that came to be is an enduring investigative project, I would say, and we're doing this every day at Brownstone, trying to piece together the timeline and figure out the evidence. I mean, I'll just give you one quick story. I mean, like, Deborah Birx, you know, even more than Fauci, exercised enormous influence over the course of the lockdowns. I mean, after March 16th, where she presided along with Trump and Fauci in this press conference that, in effect, called for, you know, shutting all schools, businesses, bars, churches, and the sports events, and everything else. That event alone basically enshrined her as a kind of a shadow dictator. And she admits in her book that she was changing reports on a weekly basis, coming from the White House and the CDC, changing them to make COVID seem more extreme, to perpetuate the lockdowns. And she traveled around the country meeting with governors and trying to persuade them to impose mask mandates and keep their businesses closed longer and that sort of thing. And she admits all this in her book. So, you know, it's super creepy to suddenly discover that for the better part of 2020, leading up to the election, Trump was only sort of cosmetically in charge, you know? And I think we all had a sense of that in those days, because he was running around from, I would say, the summer on, because after the George Floyd riots, he was like, oh, okay, so you can get out and riot and burn down our cities, but you can't meet to watch a, you know, football match, or you can't have people over your house. It's ridiculous. So he called for the opening up of the country. But he was largely ignored. I mean, there was a shadow state in place, and Birx's book goes through this shadow state problem in great detail, not a problem. And she considered it to be heroic effort on her part. And the creepiest thing about her book to me is that I think I knew this already, that she was sort of running, she was the head of a shadow regime with the benefaction of Fauci and with the cooperation of people like Francis Collins, you know, and at NIH and Redfield at CDC and also the son-in-law, Kushner, you know, who's, and also with the cooperation of Pence, who gave her protection. All this stuff was going on. But the thing that surprised me, I think most, is a sort of a meta critique of her book. Why does she feel so confident that she can write all this stuff, admit all this stuff, and not face any kind of downside to it? Like, why does she consider this bragging? Why does she think she's going to benefit professionally and in terms of history from this? And I think that has something to do with her profound level of confidence that she was on the right side of history, despite having destroyed the world. And why that is by itself very, very curious. And so we're doing some deep investigations into this, and we're pretty sure all this traces, you know, not to March, not to February, not even to January, but all the way to December of 2019, and probably all the way back to October when we first ran into the problem of the virus in Wuhan. That's when things really began to get out of control, and we're pretty sure that by December the national security state was aware of the problem. I mean, there were infected soldiers all over the country, all over the world, really, from the Wuhan Olympics in October that were carrying around the strange virus. And so by December, there was real panic. There was real clandestine meetings and that sort of thing to figure out, you know, what was going on and what to do about it. And Birx ended up being at the center of that response, in very close communication with Matthew Pottinger over at the National Security Council, I guess, and with high level security clearances, and he's the one who tapped her for the coronavirus response, even though she had no experience in respiratory viruses at all. She was just an AIDS person, you know. So these are weird things that were going on, I would say, throughout December and January.
Well, one thing about Birx, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't she openly admit in this new book that she essentially duped Donald Trump into 15 days to slow the spread, that they had no intention of it being 15 days, but she took the 15 days so they could come up with all the justifications to extend it essentially indefinitely?
Yeah, that's what she said. And that was pretty obvious to anybody looking at the data at the time, that 15 days wasn't going to achieve anything. You know? And from the beginning, this thing was slated to infect everybody. I mean, there was nothing you could do to stop that, really. And it was what happens with mild respiratory viruses. And viruses toggle between severity and prevalence, really, subject to the condition of latency. And so it was inevitable that basically everybody was going to get COVID, and it was going to become endemic in the old-fashioned way through exposure and recovery. And that was known. I knew that from February. There's no way she didn't know that.
Well, the argument, of course, at the time was, we know people will get it, or, you know, but we'll try to prevent it, but we won't want to overwhelm hospitals. So the 15 days will give hospitals time to prepare. That was probably one of the most overwhelming messages.
Yeah, that's a great line. It pertained for about 48 hours in two hospitals and two boroughs in New York. But otherwise, you know, every single state issued orders to their hospital systems. Imagine this, governor's orders to hospital systems to stop all elective surgeries and diagnostics and to preserve all resources for COVID and other extreme emergencies. And so all over the country, starting on basically March 16th, 17th, and 18th, emptied out. Parking lots were empty. I mean, my brother called me from Central Texas, and he said, "Hey, Jeffrey, I know you're following this COVID thing. I work across the street from the hospital. Why is the parking lot completely empty, even though they're open?"
Well, the media always seem to find hospitals they're completely filled up with no beds left, but, you know, in ICUs, they seem to always find it. But then, of course, other analysis said that the hospitals are designed to have near capacity for these ICU beds.
Just like restaurants. I mean, you want all the foods? You want a line up front. I mean, that's their profit-making institutions. And I have to tell you that I think it's very presumptuous. Like, even if you grant, I don't believe this, the idea that it was all designed to preserve hospital capacity. Like, even if you believe that that's what they were thinking, you cannot perfectly anticipate the severity, you know, to that degree, the severity of an impact of a virus, to perfectly project hospitalizations and thereby somehow calibrate the behavioral yeah. response perfectly and decide that, well, if we all stand 6 feet apart, that'll slow it down enough to preserve hospital capacity. This is a preposterous level of, of pretentious, you know, central planning. I mean, it's ridiculous. It makes sense in almost in a cartoonish way, but it doesn't pertain to the real world. We don't know how many people needed to be in the hospital. I mean, there's plenty of people that are very sick with COVID and decided to that they would tough it out at home. I mean, you don't want to go to the hospital. What are they going to vent you? I mean, you know, that's the other thing. The hysteria for venting in the early age days killed thousands and thousands of people before they realized this was not a good idea to shove a tube down somebody's, you know, windpipe and substitute the lungs. The second you pull it out, the lungs collapse and they die. I mean, half the people that were vented dead were dead. I mean, how many deaths was that responsible for? So
yeah, they have forced to stop that practice. But yes, and the ventilation is, you know, killing people. Well, here's a question, I admire you for your courage because I know you got a lot of tax for this. Donald Trump, you've been talking recently about how he needs to own up to his role in this. He needs to apologize. One of the things in my book I mentioned, two things. Larry Kudlow, Donald Trump's chief economic advisor, actually said in April 2020 on Fox News, he was asked directly, when is the economy, this is during the 15 days, when the 15 days had passed and it was still continuing, when is the economy going to open up? And Larry Kudlow, Donald Trump's chief economic advisor, said on air live, I don't know, that's quote, up to the health people. I really don't want to forecast, is what he said. This was a United States president ceding the entire opening of our country and our economy to previously nameless, faceless public health bureaucracy. And in the book, I actually make the case that this is one of the greatest presidential blunders in the last 50 years, that March 13th executive order. Tell me a little bit about that. What do you think Donald Trump's role and how impactful was that COVID emergency declaration on March 13th, 2020?
You know, I didn't remember that it was March 13th. That's March. Really...
Well, it's either March... Let me check that. I'm pretty sure I have that date right, but anyway.
I don't think it was March 13th. March 13th was a weird day, and I'll tell you why. Since you mentioned March 13th, March 12th was the day that Trump blocked travel from Europe in Australia.
Yeah, I have it here from the FEMA.gov. On March 13th, 2020, President Trump declared a nationwide emergency pursuant to Section 501B of the Stafford Act. That was the date that he signed the declaration.
Okay, that's good information, because that same day, the Health and Human Services Department put out a non-public lockdown order. And I've got that posted on Brownstone. You can look at it. And it recommended, you know, under community transmission, that you should shut your churches, shut your schools, shut your business, block and design. That was March 13th. And it's one thing for Trump to have issued an executive order declaring a national emergency of something.
Yeah, nationwide emergency under
that. I believe that. But you know, but that's not the same thing as the lockdown. And yet HHS is now issuing this lockdown order on March 13th. Not so much an order, but a plan. But you have a look at that PDF. You can tell it was 6 weeks, 8 weeks in the planning.
Right.
So and everything we know tells us that Trump had to be went into huddles with Birx and Fauci and Kushner and the other gangsters on the 14th and 15th. That would have been a Saturday and Sunday. And then it was during those 2 days that they persuaded him of the 2 weeks to flatten the curve. So what's striking to me is that you have the HHS releasing this March 13th sort of lockdown plan before Trump had ever approved it or maybe ever even heard of it.
Well, by declaring a national emergency, correct me if I'm wrong, wouldn't governors, mayors who did these lockdowns, weren't they invoking the national emergency? In other words, they could suspend democracy because we're in an emergency.
Sure, but so nobody...
even if technically it wasn't true, I think it's kind of like that's the way they legally or at least publicly and politically justified it by citing this March 13th.
Oh, no question about it. But I don't think in those days anybody really believed that there's such a thing as a lockdown would happen. I was writing.
Well, it led to the yes, it was still, but it still led
and
to the
lockdown. And retroactively, they could point to it just as a justification because once it's an emergency, yeah. Anything's possible. But I was warning of this January 27th, and people said I was insane. But even I didn't believe that we'd have full blown lockdowns. I thought we would have selective quarantines and other things like that. But complete lockdown. So it's just unthinkable. Trump, and we can talk about this maybe, there's plenty to talk about, but you know how Birx and Fauci tricked Trump over that weekend is a very interesting. Birx herself just, you know, claims that she just, you know, sort of blinded him with fake science, you know. Oh, here's our models, here's our models, and here's the way to fix it through social distancing and lockdowns, and he went along with it. I don't really know, but on the March 13th press conference, he was specifically asked whether he said, "Well, you know, I don't think people should be going to restaurants, and you should probably work from home if possible." And a reporter raised his hand and said, "Look, are you saying these are recommendations, or are you calling for the governors to close bars and restaurants?" He said that day. We are not calling for that. We have decided not to go there just yet. We may do that, but for now we're not doing that.
Right, but he didn't. Yeah, but of course, California, New York, Michigan, Pennsylvania—they didn't need to wait for Donald Trump. All they needed to know that was in the air, so to speak, among the public health, and they could justify it, especially with the March 13th declaration.
Not only that's true, but not only that, but immediately. Fauci stepped up to the microphone and said, "Actually, that's not true. If you read the fine print in the PDF we just passed out, it says that all bars, restaurants, public venues, sports, and everything should be closed, and that is correct. So, if you look at that PDF that was passed out on March 16th, it's two pages. The big print says, 'Wash your hands, work from home if you can.'" The small print with black background and white print, it looks like terms of use, actually said that all visits to nursing homes need to stop, all bars and restaurants need to close, and all public venues, and there need to be domestic restrictions on domestic capacity in people's homes, and that all schools should close. That was in the fine print, super fine print. And feel free to look at that PDF. I mean, there's no question in my mind that they buried that little tiny announcement. It really was like a half inch high, and I don't know what kind of, you know, one point type or
yes.
Something. Really. And so the lockdown orders were snuck in there. By the time that the CDC sent that out to all state governors and that sort of thing, the tiny print became the very large print.
Yes, which is how I guess the bureaucracy were. There were just, you know, there was a one point where Fauci gave an interview, and I it was either late January, February, where he said, "Look at what they're doing in China. We could never do that in the U.S. Can you imagine San Francisco or New York shutting down like China did?" And of course, they did imagine it, and they made it happen. So we have only about a minute left for the break. Were you surprised at the acceptance of the general public in the United States of this shutdown?
I was surprised there weren't protests in the streets. I really think it was a kind of a shock and awe thing. People were just in shock. And you know, we live in a country with human rights and freedoms, and we believe in things like freedom of association and religious liberty and free enterprise and that sort of thing. And I think a lot of the public must have just imagined that this was a plague without precedent, or else why would the government have done this? And it took quite a while for people to sort of come to terms. And then once you've made enormous sacrifices on behalf of the great goal, then you're sort of invested in it, you know? And the protests didn't really begin until the summer. And even then, once they started, the media would just trash you. You know, there were protests in Michigan and around the country. But the news media would use facial recognition technology and shame anybody who showed up to them, you know. And it was sort of an all society effort, you know, big media, big tech. We know this now. They were all cooperating. Yes.
All right. Well, we're about to go to a break, but I did find the document. It's the President's Coronavirus Guidelines for America, the very last line, and literally print that is very hard to read. In states with evidence of community transmission, bars, restaurants, food courts, gyms, other indoor and outdoor venues where groups of people congregate should be closed. That, now, of course, evidence of community transmission means, hey, there's a case in Oklahoma, there's a case in California, and that's
even if it's in the next state, right?
So yes, it's incredible. That was little noticed or not noticed at all at the time. But okay, we'll be right back. This is Mark Morano Show on TNT Radio. We're talking to Jeffrey Tucker of the Brownstone Institute. We have another segment coming up. Stay tuned.
TNT Radio's Patrick Henningsen.
His name is Blake Lovewell. Some of you may know him and his work. He's written an incredible story about cryptocurrency in Africa. Wow, this is getting extremely interesting. This is a brilliant story, and you know, it pulls you in with the story of the Central African Republic, which quite frankly, Blake, nobody knows much about.
The reason why most people haven't heard about it is because it suits international business, international miners in particular, to have that going on in the background, a sort of a shady aspect to the international economy. But really, the Central African Republic should be top of the world economy. It's got the biggest resources, natural resources, some of the biggest diamond mines. It's got oil, coal, gas for energy production. It's also got cobalt and lots of those rare earth metals and lithium, which are becoming all the more important for geopolitics and the manufacturing of microchips.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio. De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
The new European weeklies are out and they're very, very interesting. First of all, it appears that the drought is going to break in Texas over the next month to a month and a half. And it may be because of tropical activity, as Texas, for the first time, is above normal precipitation. Now, that has been what has been going on across India into Southeast Asia and Africa. Very, very wet in the equatorial areas of Africa and also southern part of the Asian subcontinent and Southwest Australia, cooler than normal. And we're also cooler than normal this year in Mexico and the northern part of South America. But the big news, I think, is that the heat wave is going to recharge in Europe. We've been saying this is going to be like August 2003. And that is going to be making headlines, including some meteorological misinformation about how this is the end of the world, which it is not. But that's the end of my story for now. This is WeatherBell.com meteorologist Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, reminding you to enjoy the weather. It is the only weather you've got.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Lowe, long jump gold medalist and world record holder. When I was 15, I was waiting to catch my train. In a split second, my life changed. As the train arrived, the crowd surged forward. I was too close to the platform edge, lost my balance, and fell into the path of the oncoming train. I was in a coma for 2 weeks, and it took 2 years to walk again. So please, stand back, look up, and stay rail safe.
This is the Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Mark Morano Show on TNT Radio. We're talking to Jeffrey Tucker, founder of the Brownstone Institute. We're talking about COVID, and we're talking about lockdowns. We're talking about public health. Let me just get a little bit political here. In June of 2020, Klaus Schwab, the founder, executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, had said that this global lockdown, I guess a few places except Sweden and a couple other places, he said of it, quote, "We need a great reset of capitalism. Virus lockdowns have, quote, given an opportunity for equality and sustainability to fight climate, and we must build a whole new economic social justice." He's called it a rare and a narrow window of opportunity by which to act. The question is, were they just lying and waiting for years for some COVID-like hysteria and lockdown to start pushing this kind of policy? His actual quote is, "The COVID pandemic represents a rare but narrow window of opportunity to reflect, reimagine, and reset our world," unquote. That's Klaus Schwab. How do you think that plays into this, that that people jumped on this, the idea of a global lockdown and all these lockdowns to start pushing stuff like this?
Well, let's see. We're talking about Klaus Schwab, who's the head of an organization to which, you know, basically every world leader is a member, every big shot on the planet Earth. If you're not a member of the World Health Organization, you're like you and I, we're just peasants and workers. You know, what do we know? At the same time, those words that you just read are almost exactly a quote from the Italian health minister, Roberto Speranza, who's responsible for locking down the Lombardy residents on February 21st. And that was the first lockdowns outside of China, right? There's a very close connection between Chinese business interests and business interests in Lombardy. But Speranza is a communist. Got a Marxist who believed that the virus was an opportunity to reset capitalism. In August, our friend Anthony Fauci wrote an article in Cell which he called for, you know, a complete restructuring of the infrastructure of, what did he call it, social existence or something like this.
Well, actually, hold on. If I can interrupt, I have it right here in front of me. COVID-19, this is Anthony Fauci in Cell Press, Cell Journal in, I believe, August or September of 2020. COVID-19 is due to extreme backlashes from nature. It will require changes in human behavior and other radical changes, rebuilding the infrastructure of human existence.
Human existence, thank you.
Exact quotes, September 3rd, 2020.
Yeah, and just so we understand what he means by that, it means that we have to empty out the cities, that you can only have a pet on the approval of him and his friends, you know. that we're probably going to have to get rid of indoor plumbing, you know. I mean, the whole thing is just, that oracle is cray-cray beyond anything you can possibly imagine. But now here you have, so you know, I don't know if anybody's ever called you a conspiracy theorist or something like that, but you know, it's very difficult to maintain the claim that, you know, that you're a wacko conspiracy theorist when you're quoting the words that some of the most powerful people have said. You know, I who was it that wrote that great book called, I think it was H.G. Wells or something, The Open Conspiracy? You know, and the idea is that if you really want to get away with something truly egregious, just announce it from the rooftops, you know?
Yeah. And Media Matters for America, the George Soros Fund group, called me a conspiracy theorist because I cite the Great Reset. But like you said, when I mentioned things like Bill Gates is the world, America's largest single farmland owner, people are like, oh, who told you that? Alex Jones? I'm like, no, that was reported by NBC News. And then I put that as a citation. I try to do all mainstream sources to avoid that. But as you say, you don't need to. What I like to say is 2020 is the year conspiracy realities outnumbered conspiracy theories.
There's no great reset except for the book by that title by the head of one of the world's most powerful policy organizations that's available on Amazon, which you can download now for like $10.
Well, let me ask you this. I'll just go back to China. And Michael Senger has done incredible work on this, and I cite
incredible. The man is an incredible researcher. He's definitely on my team and with others, you know, including Debbie Lehman today, who has this detailed article on the Deborah Birx thing. It's so intriguing about her relationship with Pottinger. But these people are doing great research, and yes, and there's Senger. You know, I used to think it was maybe, you know, some sort of xenophobic or something like that, an excessive focus on China, but it all does trace back to the CCP.
And one other thing, the way Michael Senger did it, he linked to all mainstream sources, WHO documents, in order to show, if you want to just summarize what he showed that basically the WHO, which is a puppet of China, and Bill Gates, the largest single, second donor next to the United States, the Gates Foundation, to the World Health, that Tedros they sent this fact-finding mission, I believe it was late January of 2020, to go to China. And they essentially said, if you want to know how to handle a virus, follow China. They know what they're doing. And this was as China was pounding people in their homes. So just expand on that a little bit.
So more precise, I mean, I love this. You're obsessed with the timeline. I am too. But it's February 16th, the junket to China took place, where the Potemkin village tour of Wuhan and five other cities, where the CCP dragged around officials from the World Health Organization, including the deputy assistant to Fauci from NIH and many officials from UK, took them around showing them how the Chinese strategy to crush COVID really did a brilliant job. On February 22nd, 26th, that junket ended on the 24th. So they gave them just a couple of days to produce the report, which I assume that they were writing frantically on the airplane. The metadata reveals that it was Maria Von, I can't remember her name. She was a Stanford graduate, actually works for the World Health Organization. She must have been typing it on the plane because the document came out on February 26th. That was the day that Fauci had written an email to MSNBC reporter, the Washington Post reporter, actually, saying there will be no lockdowns. We don't need a vaccine. We're going to get over this thing. Everybody just settle down. Everybody calm down.
Right.
The next day, February 27th, was the day that the New York Times went all in on virus panic. So they ran a podcast with Donald G. McNeil saying this is going to be worse than the bubonic plague. They ran an op-ed by Peter Zdadzig, which if you know that name, he was the head of EcoHealth Alliance, who was the third-party conduit for American tax dollars going from the NIH straight to the Wuhan lab. And Wolf, he had an op-ed on that day the New York Times, and you had on that day Deborah Birx was hired as the Corona Task Force person. And the same day that Fauci wrote Morgan Fairchild, does that name anything to you?
She's Morgan Fairchild? Oh, yeah, the actress, you mean? Yes.
Yeah. He wrote her and said, you need to warn your followers that lockdowns are coming. Why he thought somehow she was the person to contact, you know, I don't know. That's a generational issue.
Yeah.
So something happened. Something happened between when the planes took off from China to come back home on the 24th of February and the 27th, and I think it was that night. It was that night of the February 26th where something happened to change Fauci's mind, to get the New York Times all in. You know, I don't know. I don't know who the players were. I wish I did, because there's something, I still feel like there's a missing piece here. You know, there's something.
What do you make, and not to get conspiratorial here, we wouldn't want to do that, but what do you make of those simulations, those the 2010 Rockefeller report, which envisioned a tighter top-down government control, authoritarian leadership with limited innovation, and they were recommending essentially a lockdown back then. And then you had like Event 201. The WEF hosted a Glade X1, which simulated a real virus outbreaks. And some of these, they did videos of like fake newscasts and fake epidemiologists meeting. And they actually say in some of them, we need to shut down the internet because of misinformation is our public health threat. They openly talk about a global shutdown of the internet so that people can't communicate and misinform each other because it would kill people. What do you make of all these dry runs by John Hopkins and Rockefeller, World Economic Forum? Is this just what they always do and people are making too much of it? Or was this like a blueprint that they were able to hearken back to and have ready to go when COVID hit?
There is such a thing called lockdown ideology. It's not communism. It's not capitalism. It's not fascism. It's like techno-primitivism. And they believe in ending social life and freedom altogether. It's worse than all those ideologies combined, actually. And that has been developing since 2006. It's been constantly out there. And it was innovated by, you know, the Bush White House. and went to...
This was the one allegedly started by a high school kid, and their father was a Bush official and picked it up. That story got challenged, but it's hard to say.
There's nothing wrong about that story. It's 100%.
Okay.
Robert Glass over at the Sandia National Laboratory was tasked with coming up with a model to figure out how to stop the spread of a virus. So what they wondered would be, something like a bioterrorism or something like that. So he was intrigued by a science project his daughter was working on that.
Yeah.
Based on a kind of a cooties model, how do you keep it separate? And what she said was, you can't possibly stop the spread of cooties as long as all the kids are riding on school buses together, And so that gave him allegedly this great epiphany. And then he developed certain acolytes, based on his whiz-bang modeling skills. And the guy was not trained in viruses or anything. He was just one of these wacko computer programmer guys. And they all were, actually, in those days. None of them were epidemiologists or real medical people at all. None of them. But they started developing acolytes, like Richard Hatchett and Carter Mitra, who's the great hero of Michael Lewis's book Premonition, who worked for these, some extremely dopey. I mean, he was an emergency room physician in Chicago. Imagine being fired from that job and going to work for the VA. So this guy's utterly, completely pathetic, but a complete acolyte of Robert Glass and his daughter's theories. Laura Glass. I don't know why I always say. That was all the way back in 2006, but they were considered to be crazy people, But what happened was that, of course, they got a key convert in their wild ideology, the name of whom is Bill Gates.
Ah, yes.
And so then billions of dollars later, every epidemiology department and journal, scientific journal and news media outlet and everything was completely corrupted by this spectrum-y lockdown advocate. So,
well, we only have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you about this COVID climate connection. Harvard School of Public Health, and I believe it was December 2020. It could have been November, but by December, they had this on their website. Harvard School of Public Health, the root causes of climate change also increase the risk of pandemics. We need to take climate action to prevent the next pandemic. This was followed up April of this year, a study that came out, a modeling study, a climate model. Climate change will make pandemics like COVID more likely. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How do you see that connection between the climate activists and the climate agenda, if you will, with COVID? In other words, if you don't support this, are you a grandma killer? If you don't support the Green New Deal, are you a grandma killer because you're going to create more COVIDs?
Yeah, this is all public relations. All the people who want the state to be gigantic and private enterprise and freedom to go away, we're always looking for a reason. I mean, in the Middle Ages, they looked to heresy. In late Middle Ages, they looked to witchcraft. And so now, they figured out, based on the last two and a half years of experience, that the pandemic disease is a great way to terrify the population. So now you just have every rotten cause out there hooking its sort of wagons to this great thing. So no matter what your insane ideology is, if you just can link it somehow to the fear of pandemics, then you've got a good thing going. This is going to go on for another 10 or 20 years,
All right. Well, final minute, I'll let you wrap up. Here's a question. They want to declare Joe Biden is being urged by Senator Elizabeth Warren, by Chuck Schumer, by House Democrats to declare a national climate emergency, which the Center for Bio, one of the big environmental groups, said it will give Biden 130 immediate executive powers. What do you make of that? Could we face another type of energy lockdown situation? Do you think that could happen? Or do you think that... there's a different mechanism when you're talking about that. But the World Health Organization declared climate the number one health threat in 2018 before COVID. What do you think of this whole thing? And how do you, going forward, just go ahead and wrap up and sum up your views on this whole thing, especially climate emergency as it relates to COVID emergency.
The great disaster of March 2020 is that it taught all governments in the world that they only had to whip up a wild frenzy, and unthinkable things can happen. They can shut your churches, shut you in your home, lock you down, stop your travel, take away your rights that we fought for the last 500 years. Right? They can do all this if they can whip up a big enough public frenzy about it and get the news media working with them. And so, unfortunately, this is going to be the rest of our lives. We're going to be dealing with this forever. The enemies of freedom are on the march, and they are going to use any excuse. So they think now that anything is possible. And I think we, too, should believe that anything is possible, which means that everyone, without exception, needs to throw himself or herself into the intellectual battle now. Because we are talking about an existential struggle for the future of civilization, or even its existence, as we understand that term. This is serious. This is
Thank you. This has been talking with Jeffrey Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute, author of the book Liberty or Lockdown, has a new book coming out on the administrative state. Thank you so much for taking the time here, Jeffrey. Appreciate it.
So nice to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. This is the Mark Morano Show on TNT Radio. We'll be right back.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
George Soros is one of the United States' top political and advocacy donors, spending billions on campaigns, think tanks, startups, and nonprofits that promote his agenda. His principal philanthropic network includes the Open Society Foundations and Foundation to Promote Open Society, two multi-billion dollar left-of-center grant-making foundations. Through these organizations, Soros has funded the vast majority of the most prominent left-progressive advocacy groups in the United States. Financial ties between the Black Lives Matter movement and Soros have been reported, as well as financial ties to Occupy Wall Street through intermediaries like the Tide Center. The network of Soros-funded organizations indirectly touches 30 media organizations. George Soros spent tens of millions on political campaigns affiliated with the Democratic Party in 2016 and heavily supported Hillary Clinton. In the first 3 months of 2020, George Soros had put $28.3 million into various efforts to support the Democratic side in the 2020 election. In August 2021, Soros contributed $1 million to support California Governor Gavin Newsom in his recall election against Republican challengers.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah, 24/7, 365, we never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio. Mark Morano on today's news talk radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Mark Morano Show on TNT Radio, coming at you in early August 2022. Okay, that was Jeffrey Tucker. That was a fantastic interview, and I urge you to follow him on Twitter. I urge you to check out the Brownstone Institute, and I urge you to read my book where I feature both Michael Senger, who he praised, researcher, and Jeffrey Tucker, and many others. As we lay out this case of the great reset and what's happened to American life under all of these, under the COVID-19 lockdowns and mandates. But I wanted to give you an update since last week. There's been a couple developments of just sheer insanity, sheer wackiness happening in the world of climate, energy, and the environment. And this next story is just like almost unbelievable, but it's real. It happens. It's a story from Scientific American. And essentially, this is a story about humans being pollution. This is where this is all headed. In other words, before we were a virus, we were virus spreaders and needed to be locked down, controlled, canceled, stay at home. But this is a new one. This is an actual headline of the publication Scientific American, a popular science journal. Eating too much protein makes pee a problem pollutant in the U.S. This was published, citing a study published in the journal Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. And the gist of this is, and what my headline at Climate Depot was, you are the pollution they want to eliminate. Human pee is a problem pollutant, can contribute to warming. In other words, they're claiming, and this is also an attack on keto diets for you all out there. And by the way, as an aside, the old United States food pyramid chart that had you eating all that bread, creating the diabetes and obesity problem we've had since the 1970s, was essentially a model lobbied by food producers. And you can watch a movie called Food Inc. by Robbie Kenner, and they show you all of the scientists testifying, saying, we don't know that this is it. We're still studying diet and food and nutrition. For the government to take this stand and say this is the only way forward is wrong. I mean, the scientists are on record testifying, the U.S. Senate. They were overruled because bureaucrats and lobbyists and lawyers took over and said, no, this is the ultimate diet. And that's what happened. So essentially, in the same vein now, this is what's happened, how climate got captured, how COVID got captured. It's not so much the science that wins. It's the powerful, the lobbyists, the moneyed interest. And now we have a situation where human pee is considered a pollutant and dangerously warming the environment. So what I say is they will not give up. The climate activists aren't giving up. The powers that be, they will continue to scare you about climate change in every way and in any conceivable way. Now when you pee, you are allegedly a human pollution machine that is heating up the planet. The voiding of your bladder must be curtailed for the sake of the planet. So says the science. This is the absurd spectacle upon which we are facing now. In addition to that, we've had the continuation of shutting down of American, and I'm sorry, not American, but global agriculture from Sri Lanka to the Netherlands. Canada is now stepping up their war on modern high-yield fertilizer, high-yield agriculture that has fed the world. And the ultimate now, we have UK environmentalist George Monbiot, who's a key advisor to Greta Thunberg, a favorite of the UK Guardian. He's always on the BBC. He is now saying that, he's just putting it real simple, shutting down animal farming altogether is necessary because it's one of the greatest causes of climate breakdown. And I wanted to play you this clip because it's so just over the top and insane that you have to hear it for yourself. So here is George Monbiot talking about how we essentially need to shut down modern agriculture.
It's by far and away the greatest cause of habitat destruction, the greatest cause of wildlife loss, the greatest cause of extinction, greatest cause of soil loss, greatest source of fresh water use. It's one of the greatest causes of climate breakdown, bigger than transport, one of the primary causes of water pollution and of air pollution.
And he goes on, and he basically declares that we need to switch out of farming altogether to produce protein-rich foods. Now, this is the way you end up with lab-grown fake meat. This is the way you end up with pushing insects. By the way, Stephen Colbert had on Robert Downey Jr., the actor, pushing animal paste, insect paste, sorry, not animal paste, but insect paste to use as sort of protein powder because of these alleged problems of farming. But now when you have mainstream environmentalists in the UK on major, this was actually, he said this on Irish state TV about stopping all animal agriculture. It just reveals the agenda, the naked agenda of what they want to do. They don't want to put, as Prince Charles says, face masks on cow. They don't want to limit your meat eating. They don't want to, you know, just get rid of some of the fertilizer because they want to shut it down. Now, if you go back and you look at the Club of Rome in the early 1970s, a sort of Malthusian group that started, and same as the Paul Ehrlich, where you have essentially they predicted scarcity, food shortages, famine. The world can't handle this population. We have the German climate advisor, Hans Schulenhuber, who I interviewed at a UN climate summit, basically saying the carrying capacity of planet Earth is about 1 billion people. Keep in mind, we have almost 8 billion people. They essentially want to eliminate almost 7 billion people to make us sustainable. Well, how would you go about doing that? By making, the World Economic Forum's Great Reset says meat will be a rare and expensive treat. But I think now we're finding that food is going to be a rare and expensive treat. And are you ready for this? Because I'm predicting this. This is the kicker of it all. All of these policies that are creating collapse, Bill Gates buying up farmland, China buying up farmland, China buying up meat processing plants, supply chain issues, the lockdowns, inflation, and all the regulations killing the small independent farmers, turning it over to all corporate farming, which is going to toe the line of the sort of the paymasters at the UN Sustainable Development Agenda 2030 and the UN Great Reset. What they're going to do is, as they collapse our food system and we end up with food shortages, what do you think they're going to blame these food shortages on? Not their policies, which is clearly what's creating the food shortages. They're going to blame it on climate change. Once they blame these food shortages, which they created through their policies and ideology, on climate change, what do you think their solution's going to be? More regulations, more restrictions in order to stop the climate change that's causing the food shortage. It's a circular feedback loop that ends with a reduction in human, an involuntary reduction in human population. You are being warned. You are being warned. You are being warned. There's a great author named Alex Newman who wrote about the, and I want to get the name of this right because it was a Canadian UN Sustainable Development Declaration. I want to get this right so you have an idea. They don't believe that land ownership is viable and that land ownership should not be allowed because it creates inequity. This was essentially what a UN declaration had announced. And if you start looking at that, you realize, what are the Dutch farmers in the Netherlands fighting over? They're fighting over losing their land. We have the specter where they could actually lose their land, lose ownership of their land, but actually remain on it. And they could end up working for the big corporatist elite, China, Bill Gates style billionaire, whoever buys the land after they go into default because they're not allowed to farm it. And then what? Then you're going to have a situation almost like feudal serfdom, where these people are just going to be tilling the land that they once owned, paying their paymasters as they try to rifle down the human food population. But don't worry, we're still going to get food. It's going to be fake lab grown meat, and it's also going to be insects. And the insects, you cannot underestimate the impact by which they are pushing the insect eating on the population. Also this week, on the same venue, the World Economic Forum is calling for essentially more steps to end private car ownerships. And this is what is shocking, because people are acting, this is now making it in the mainstream news. Fox News actually reported this, which they don't usually report on this stuff. They're looking to reduce private car ownership. And their way they call it, because it's idle equipment. In other words, if you're not driving your car 24/7 or a lot during the day, that's a waste of time. Our global elites have said you don't need to own it. And so what's happened here is, I point out in my special report at Climate Depot that the UK Transport Secretary has already said owning a car is outdated 20th century thinking. The Irish Times is talking about ending car ownership. in an editorial. The Business Insider magazine headline, "Electric vehicles won't save us. We need to get rid of cars completely." They don't care who owns it. They just want them gone. They want everyone stuffed into cities, and they want suburbs gone, and they want mass transit where everyone's going to have to wear masks and be locked down. But not only that, you have the Gates Soros-funded professor, Mariana Marcuse, who actually coined the phrase climate lockdowns back in 2020. She said the government would limit private vehicle use. The British Medical Journal did a study calling for substantially fewer journeys by cars. So this is not an accident. This is not some, this is just silliness. I actually, if you go to Climate Depot, have all the sources, citations to original links. This is happening. It's part of the Great Reset. We need to form the Great Reject, the Great Resist. We need to fight back at this. Special thanks to my guest, Jeffrey Tucker, for the Brownstone Institute for tonight's show. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Mark Morano Show on TNT Radio. Thank you for listening.